From slide 68 on, an example of an half-duplex point-to-point protocol is presented. We have to imagine that this entire half-duplex protocol is made through the presence of three layers that interact reciprocally in order to grant the communication. Generally speaking, we are making reference to the so-called ISO-OSI model and not the complete one, but let's say a reduced version consisting of three layers. The application layer, that is that group of functions that are available to the user so as he, she avoids to deal with all the problems and the issues that are related to the physical aspects of the communications. Typically, in a layered architecture, the functions available in the higher layer use and call those functions that are present in the underneath ones. The second layer that we are conceiving is the so-called data link or communication layer, and the third one is called physical layer, called in this way because it is tightly connected with the serial communication hardware. All the assembly routines that we have seen in the previous lessons lie in this layer, and functions coded in a higher level language belonging to higher levels will use them to accomplish the communication task. In the slide 68, we start considering the characteristics of the message that is referred in the application layer. That is, application processes available to the user will refer to a message by defining the type of the bytes inserted into the message itself, the number of the characters of which the message consists, and the text that represents the real content of the information exchanged. These will be the only variables that it is necessary to know and to define at the level of the user. The functions that are available in the application layer are typically a function that allows to set up the communication, a function that in case of transmission will insert the message that must be sent into the transmission queue, and in the opposite direction, let's say, a function that takes the message from the reception queue. In case of the remote system doesn't transmit nothing, the message that is received is by convention defined by a type equal to zero and a unique byte equal to zero in the text, in the content. Then we have to define the format of the message, and here we basically repeat the considerations that we have already mentioned in the past. That is, a message is characterized by a start of header, a type, as we said, a number of characters, a text, a checksum, and by two variables that represent the so-called progressive code of the current message and the progressive code of the last message correctly received. That is, considering that the data exchange between two partners is made by several messages, the concept is that together with the information exchange, we send an order number of the part that currently is sent, so as this order number allows to the receiver, the destination point, to understand if the sequence has been correctly received. On the contrary, the destination point will exchange its own order number of the different parts of the message that have been received, so as to make the transmitter to understand if all these parts have been correctly received. These two variables, called progressive T and progressive R, in such a kind of an example, are included into the content of the message that is transmitted between the sender and the destination. In the slide 69, on the other hand, the data structures and the communication procedures that are relative to the data link layer, or the layer that is devoted to the processes that concretely manage the communications, are presented. In terms of data structures, we refer to two kind of queues that are devoted to the reception of the messages and to the transmission of the messages. Moreover, we have a buffer that contains those characters that are devoted to the reception of the current message, and the buffer that is devoted to the transmission of characters that belong to the current message. In other words, the situation that we have in mind is related to the fact that the real interface between the present partner of the communication and the serial line is represented by the two buffers that will capture what is arriving from the network, or will send into the network the particular message that must be sent. In any case, the two buffers are interfaced in turn with the two queues that contain those messages that must be transmitted, and on a step-by-step basis will fill the transmission buffer for going on into the network, or that contain those messages that must be elaborated, processed by the microprocessor, and that will be filled time after time by the message that arrives into the receiving buffer. Of course, we need suitable functions that work accordingly to the general concept on which the queues and the buffers are based. Therefore, we find the GET transmission procedure that extracts the message from the transmission queue and will send it into the transmission buffer. If the queue is empty, the message that will be sent is characterized by the type 0 and a unique byte equal to 0. Conversely, we will find also another function called putReceiverBuffer that will insert the message taken from the receiving buffer into the receiving queue. We will have also two functions that work in interrupt mode. The first is devoted to the reception of a character. Eventually, even in case of an error, it is called, but Its main function is to take a character from the receiving buffer register and put it into an array that will represent that message received by the remote sending unit, and that will be entered into the buffer register. At the same time, we will have a interrupt transmission function that is executed in interrupt mode, and this function will execute the dual activity, that is, under interrupt, when the transmission register is empty, this function will fill this register with the next character that must be sent. Again, just to complete the message following the format that we have previously described, that has to be sent to the destination point. Finally, we have a function that basically provides a timestamping of the current activities that are in progress, and typically it is used to detect the timeout amount that indicates the end of a message. In the slide number 70, we have summarized in a graphic way the data structure that are provided and the routine that work on them. The first row corresponds to the direction into which the transmission takes place. First of all, we have a routine called put transmission that inserts the messages in the queue of the messages devoted to the transmission. From that queue, the routine get transmission takes the present message that is inserted into the buffer for the transmission, and from that buffer the routine write THR will send on a character by character basis the message to the partner of the communication. Conversely, the second row corresponds to the line, to the direction of the reception of messages. We have the get reach routine that takes a message from the queue and will pass it to the present unit, to the local microprocessor for the elaboration. We have a put reach that takes the last message received from the buffer devoted to the reception of the messages and inserts it into the queue devoted to such a kind of messages. And we have the read receive buffer register that gets the characters that arrive from the network and will insert them into the buffer devoted to the reception to compose on a step-by-step basis the message that will be taken by the put reach and inserted into the queue. The picture in the lower right part of the figure instead remembers to us the reduced version of the ISO-OSI model that we have implemented in such a kind of half-duplex point-to-point protocol for the communication that is made of an application layer to which the user code directly makes access, and through a data link layer and through a physical layer arrives directly to the physical network that is used for the data exchange. And now it's time to deal with an example of code that manages the message reception and the transmission under interrupt. The interrupt vectorization routines have been configured with the initialization of register and their identification through the IIR of the interrupt origin, and follows the rules that we have presented in the previous slides. In slide 71, the variables managed at the communication level are presented. The code that we will see is organized as a finite state machine. So we have two variables that are called status T and status R that represent the status of the finite state machine in the transmission phase and of the finite state machine in the receiving phase. Then we have four progressive, two related to the status of the transmission and two related to the status of the reception. Two of them are local and two of them are remote. In the concept of the transmission, we have a local node and a remote node. Every node is in possess of the progressive that says how the transmission is going on locally and from the remote node point of view, and how the reception is going on locally and from the remote point of view. So to have the status of the alignment of transmission and reception from both the two point of view of the two nodes that are exchanging data, and that on a time-by-time basis become transmitter and receiver. Other variables are the checksums for the verification of the code, both in the transmission phase and in the reception phase, because a message is made by several components and the sum of all of them will produce the checksum to be transmitted. And in the receiving phase, we will read all the components, we will add them, and the remote local checksum will be compared to the transmission one, so as to verify if everything was okay. Then we have two indexes, one for the current position in the transmission buffer and one for the current position in the reception buffer, and finally two long integer variables that allow us to store the present timestamping and the last monitored timestamping. They are called tempo core and tempo prech, that means current time and previous time. And basically, as we said before, they are used to evaluate if an interval of time has passed that is greater than the timeout typically used to identify the end of the transmission. Moreover, the variable count will indicate the number of the characters of the text that must be received. In slide 72, we have an example of a routine that is devoted to the reception of a message that could be executed under interrupt. This routine is elaborated, is executed every time a byte is received in the receiver buffer register, and it is structured as a finite state machine that depending on the particular phase of the construction of the message executes different instructions. In particular, the variable that discriminates among the different status of the part of the routine that must be executed is the variable stato R that expresses the present status of the receiving phase in such a kind of communication. The first routine that is processed is the so-called LEGI RBR that takes from the receiver buffer register the currently present byte and writes it into the variable byte. So we understand that this routine is called by an interrupt that is triggered by the presence of the byte into the RBR. Or conversely, we could also imagine that it is executed after having read the line status register and having found the bit corresponding to the presence of a byte in the RBR as set. In any case, after the acquisition of the byte, we check the line status register and we write the result of the check into the variable errori. If errori, that is, looking at all those masks that say if an overrun, a framing error, a parity error, or a breaking have been found, the routine executes the LEGI tempo, that is, evaluates the present time, writes it into the tempo patch, and set the status variable to an erroneous flag. All these operations are always executed when entered into the routine. Now we have a switch that decides what part of the next code will be executed depending on the different phases into which we are. If the stato R, that is the present flag of the finite state machine, is as zero, we ask if the byte that we have received is the start of header, that is the beginning of a message. In that case, we set the stato R to S1 for the next phase. Otherwise, we check the time, we assign it to tempo patch, because now we have to wait a suitable time to exit from the erroneous status, and we set the flag of the finite state machine to SR, that is erroneous state. If instead the flag was S1 in the logic that we have described on which the message structure is based, we expect the next remote progressive for the transmission. The first operation we execute in this phase is the reset of the receiving checksum, the initialization of the index of the buffer devoted to the reception of a message, and we assign the byte that we have received to the variable remote transmission progressive. We add this byte to the checksum in reception, and we set the status flag to the next phase, that is S2, and then we make a break, that is we exit from the switch phase. The next step concerns the case S3. In this phase, the byte that we are waiting for is the so-called type code. Again, it is stored in the variable byte. We put it into the receiver buffer for the message that we are carrying out. We increase the index IR and we add this byte to the checksum in reception, and we set the status flag for the next phase. The next phase hopefully will be the S4. The byte that we should receive is the number of the bytes that characterize the text of the message we want to receive. We insert this byte into the array. We increase the index. We assign this byte to the variable count. We add it to the checksum in reception, and we set the status flag to the next phase, S5. In S5, basically, we receive the bytes of the message, so the present byte is inserted into the array buffer each. We increase the index, we add the byte to the checksum, and we begin to diminish the counting variable. If this is zero, this means that we have finished to receive the bytes of the message. Otherwise, we break from the present state without upgrading the variable stato R and remaining in S5. Only when the bytes of the message are exhausted, the new status flag will be S6. And this is the phase that we go to describe, because in this case we wait for the checksum that has been evaluated in the sending unit. So this byte must be compared with the checksum in reception that we have built, adding every byte that we received in this routine. And if the comparison is okay, we execute the subroutine putReach with argument buffReach that inserts the buffer containing the present received message into the queue of the messages that have been received, and that must be elaborated by the processor. Now, the progressive remote transmission can be successfully assigned to the progressive local received, because no errors took place in this reception, and in the perfect logic of the alternation that characterizes the half-duplex protocol, the reception is disabled and the transmission is enabled. The two routines are written in the and executed in this state, and the flag of the status is reset to the initial state S0. Otherwise, the checksum was not correct, the comparison failed, and we have to signal that an erroneous situation has been found, so stato R is equal to SR, and as usual we read the time through the legit tempo and we assign it to the variable tempo prech, and we exit from the switch phase. Finally, let's make a small comment about the part of the switch in the code that is related to the error state, that is the part executed when the switch detects that the status variable is equal to SER. In this case, the first operation is to read the present time. And then, if the difference between the previous acquisition of the time is greater than a suitable timeout value fixed during the configuration of the routine. And the byte that has been received is a start of message. In this case, we can exit from the status error, and we set status R equal to 1, S1. Otherwise, we set the present timestamping value to the previous one tempo patch, and we exit from this status. That is, if we lose some information due to an error, everything which will come next will be discarded, and we will wait for the timeout we have set at the beginning, and a new message that is starting. The concurrent occurrence of both these two conditions is considered the way out from the erroneous status, otherwise we will remain into it. In the slide 73, on the other hand, the C code is presented that depicts application program that is used to transmit bytes similarly to the previous one conceived. Of course, differences are present due to the fact that now we are transmitting and we are using different variables and functions, but the logic more or less is the same one. Important remark is that the main concept shared between the two codes that perform reception and transmission of each message byte is the fact that we continuously check the bytes if what we have written related to the transmitting phase has been correctly received by my partner and vice versa, then the communication is going on well. In particular, the check has been, the control, I mean, has been coded in two parts. We have already mentioned that we check the line status register, but moreover, we always monitor the remote received progressive number, comparing it with the local transmission progressive number. If they are equal, everything is fine. Otherwise, no. Let's give a quick comment for sake of completeness to this code containing the function called scrivi byte word. In particular, we find a transmission buffer used to contain those messages that have been just processed and elaborated and which will be sent to the correct destination once they are put in the user transmission holding register. If for any possible reason this transmission buffer is empty, buf tra is equal null in the code, the protocol doesn't stop, but it will send a buffer containing the following things. Buf tra in the location 0 will be 0, that is the message type is null, and buf tra in the location 1 is 1, since we have only one byte in the text, and buf tra in the location 2 will be null, since the unique text byte is 0. We also find a function that is used to write in the transmission hold register of the serial port. That is the same function we have described in slide 63, when we explained how to transmit a character through the polling control. Eventually, this function can be executed also under interrupt. Coming back to the body of the transmission function, we will send the same sequence of information correspondingly to those bytes we have described in the dual receiving function. So the start of header, the progressive local transmission number, the progressive local remote number to perform the control if what has been transmitted has been correctly received. Then the type of the message that we are exchanging, and then the byte count and the content of the information that are exchanged. Finally, we have the checksum, the transmission checksum, that is built the same way we have seen before, that is by summing every byte we are sending. This value will be sent to the receiver, and it allows to control that the sum of what has been received is equal to what has been transmitted. The last part of the code corresponding to the value S7 of the status flag establishes the end of the transmission, and in this sense we have to remember what we said when we are transmitting the last byte onto the network. We said that the real transmission foresees the transfer of the last byte from the transmission hold register to the shift register in output. But if we disable the transmission phase in this moment, we make an error because we stop basically the activity of the shift register that eventually could be still in progress in the transmission. So we have to foresee a suitable delay that allows to wait the necessary time for having the output of all the bytes, not only through the transmission holding register, but also through the output shift register. Then we can have the right logic of alternation between the two partners of the communication, that is, let's disable the transmission, let's enable the reception of the messages that my interlocutor could send me, and let's set the flag of the status to the initial phase of the state machine we have defined, and let's break out from the switch phase. The three next slides illustrate a typical station that is devoted to footwear. In slide 74, we see how a normal shoe that we can find in a typical shop is the assembly of several parts that are carried out separately, typically not with a manual activity, but using a numeric controlled machine, that can be grouped into a location that put them physically very close, and shown in slide 75, could foresee that most, if not all, of these machines are connected through a system that brings the parts, in this case the show of the show, generally speaking of the product that is in progress, on every station for adding the next part to the overall product. At every station, we can imagine the presence of a human operator, but in some cases we can also foresee the presence of a robot. For example, in the specific production chain that we are considering, you see that we have an application of the insole station, upper humidification, two-end machine, a tack lasting machine, a stabilizing oven, a pounding roughing machine, a gluing for the last and the sole, then an air driving reactivation, then a sole pressing, a freezer, a last remove, and a heel fixing. Several stations into which the show undergoes a particular and specific processing. The general idea could be why we don't connect all these machines so as to put them under the control of, for example, a single computer. And this clearly requires data exchange from the computer to the machines, but sometimes even between the machines themselves. And this data exchange typically must respect many constraints. For example, it must be very robust with respect to the possible presence of noise into the surroundings, but also must respect a communication protocol that very often is typical of the production chain that we are considering. Moreover, such a communication, let's say architecture, typically joins machines that come not from the same manufacturer, so may feature differences and troubles in terms of connections and data that can be exchanged. All these issues justify the idea of designing and then carrying out a communication protocol that is typical of industrial applications and tries to respect those constraints that can be found in that environment, while instead are not typical of the general world of the network. This is the idea under which the so-called field buses have been considered. Field buses allow the standardization of the communications between devices that are used in data acquisition and in the industrial real-time distributed control. In fact, as we have seen, a complex automated industrial system, such as a manufacturing assembly line, usually needs a distributed control system, an organized hierarchy of controller systems to properly work. In this hierarchy, there is often the presence of a human machine interface at the top, where an operator can monitor or control the system. Typically, this is linked to a middle layer of programmable logic controllers, PLC, via a non-time critical communication system. At the bottom of the control chain, we find the field bus that connects the PLCs or every other intelligent device to the components that actually do the work, such sensors, actuators, electric motors, console lights, switches, valves, and contactors. A field bus is an industrial network system for real-time distributed control, and often it is a way to connect instruments in a manufacturing plant. Field buses work on a network structure which typically allows a daisy chain, star, rings, branches, and tree network topologies. In the past, computers were connected using protocols like the one that we have already seen, 232, by which only two devices could communicate. And we have seen a couple of variants into which the number of communicating devices was extended to 42, but not at the same time. Instead, a field bus grants the following features: periodic communication with sensors and commands toward actuators. This is done following a certain set of predefined action that are considered a priori in the aim also to assure the real-time elaboration and control. Aperiodic communication due to high priority events like alarms, anomalies, and so on. Aperiodic communication due to low priority information request as initial configuration, diagnostic request, and so on. In particular, in this framework, we will focus our attention onto the CAN bus topic, that is a very popular field bus developed originally for the automotive application, but now very popular, very, very diffused in the industrial world. A CAN bus, a controller area network bus, is a robust standard designed to allow microcontrollers and devices to communicate with each other in application without a host computer necessarily present. It is a message-based protocol, as we said, originally designed for multiplex electrical wiring with automobiles to save on copper, but it is now also used in many other contexts. As we have said before, field buses are quite similar to typical networks used in industrial applications, for example, like Ethernet, but they present a set of characteristics devoted to those problems that are particularly important in industrial communications, like those related, for example, to assure real-time communications, and like those related to robustness. In other words, there is a particular attention to the quality of the data that are electronically transmitted in the communication media, but also there are solutions and approaches that allow to exit from potentially dangerous situations that, for example, could arise when a conflict on the same network between the interlocutors happen. Field buses, and in particular the CAN bus that we will see, implement some algorithms just to transform the situation from potentially undeterministic and therefore not real-time in mainly deterministic. That is, it will be possible to foresee a priori if and how much time we could lose in a certain situation. Moreover, we can manage to exit from a conflict situation. Another issue very critical and important in field buses is how they allow the organization of the data. For every node connected to the bus, we have a set of logic data organized, for example, just to be clear, as a database. And these data are typically the variables that are acquired by means of sensors. This aspect can be considered typical in field buses and not in other popular and diffused communications protocol. For example, in Ethernet, we don't have a specific database that contains the measurement taken with the sensor. Ethernet will be used to transmit those data, but in the communication specification, it is not foreseen a data structure explicitly conceived for that target. This is more evident if we analyze the concept of historical database that is very peculiar in field buses. With a historical database, we don't mean data coming from the sensors only, but we mean a set of events that are organized in queues, into which every queue contains a temporal order of actions that must be activated and, of course, terminated. This is very compliant with the industrial situations because in a farm we have a set of operations that must be performed from the morning up to the evening, and we need also to associate that event with the time and the relative data. And this is typical, we could say mandatory, in industrial applications and not, for example, in a general database or in a website. We could say that it will be possible, but not mandatory. So, in such a way, we can better understand how the logical organization of the data and the operations relative to them that is allowed by many field buses is industrially relevant and not general purpose. Previously, we have defined the typical services that are required to the field buses. But there are also constraints that typically field buses must respect. First of all, the frequency with which data are refreshed should be instantaneous, that is, should reproduce the frequency with which the sensors are sampled and read. In other words, the overhead introduced by a field bus doesn't compromise the correct sampling of the physical phenomenon that we are reading and monitoring. Moreover, values should have a suitable time validity. The devices are typically far one from the other, and the distance between, for example, a producer and the consumer of the information that the producer makes available implies a delay that must not compromise the system stability. We have learned in the course of mechatronics how to eliminate the effect of a delay, but we will see, especially in the CAN bus, specific solutions that try to compensate for such a kind of delay. Another issue that must be considered and respected is the so-called temporal coherence. That is, data received from many different producers must refer to the same time period. If you want, this is another point of view of the previous consideration. The distance between the producer must not be a problem, And at the same time, if we want to have an overall snapshot of the behavior of a process, we need that all the variables that are sampled have been taken into a specific and correct for our purposes time window. Spatial coherence. If more controllers use the same variable, clearly they must use identical values, and this is a typical, let's say, computer science problem. Interoperability. It is clear that the systems, the machines, the devices that are connected through a field bus are typically from different manufacturers. But on the other hand, that was one of the reasons that motivated the design and the implementation of field buses. In the past, we have talked about periodic communication, a periodic communication with high and low priority. Sporadic communication, messages that must be affected by the minimum possible delay. In other words, messages that are so rare, but even so important, in some cases dramatic, that cannot tolerate any minimum delay. And the interface issue, if possible, to interact with such a kind of communication systems should be simple, reliable, safe, and possibly cheap. Concerning transmission media, we can say that in case of field buses, we don't have big differences with respect to the situation of general purpose and popular networks. In other words, we can find field buses based on copper cables, typical in particular short medium distance connections, that means from meters to kilometers, with a bandwidth, however, that diminishes with the distance due to the dissipation in the medium. To achieve velocities greater than megabits per second with great distances, in this case, repeaters or bridges are mandatory. Twisted pairs of cables that are cheap, with a good noise immunity and respectable transmission velocities, they can be shielded, but not always, and they are also used to power supply the devices connected through the bus, for example, using the modulation of the signal. Coaxial cables, definitely better in terms of bitrate and electromagnetic compatibility, and also in terms of distances that can be reached than the previous solutions. Typically, coaxial cables are used where technical difficulties don't allow the use of optical fibers. For example, when vibrations characterize the environment into which the cables must pass. We can even consider to use those cables that are employed for the energy transport to bring the communication wherever we want, typically in public buildings. Such a kind of solution is used when automatic devices must be installed in buildings, or when we need to bring digital communications exploiting wide distribution supports, for example, the water, electricity, and gas distribution. In this case, the transmission is made using the main carrier line that controls the distribution of the particular support we are considering, and modulating the carrier, superimposing the signal that we wanted to bring elsewhere on the alternate current network voltage, and using in such a way the same transmission medium. This kind of solution, however, is very sensible to electromagnetic disturbs. Of course, we have optical fibers, the most performing at now technology in terms of velocity, distance, and electromagnetic compatibility, but however expensive. In particular, the new plastic optical fiber technology seems to reduce the costs, so it is possible that in few years this will become the dominant technology. And finally, Wi-Fi, ever and ever increasing, but very sensible to disturbances, so not always used, in particular in very hard and critical applications.